Hey everybody, this is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman back for the 177th Green Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition Zoom call. We have got, as always, a wonderful gathering to deal with today. We have 18 people, which is a magic number going on up. And we're going to start the 2 hours today with the great Jerry Ashton, who has retired. Jerry, you can give us the number. God knows how much medical debt. And I got a new focus on veterans, which is a very, very big deal. And we're going to take up all the time you need, Jerry, to talk about that today, because it's something that we can immediately accomplish and absolutely changes people's lives. It's a fantastic thing. We're then going to talk. We're going to try and give everybody a chance to talk in the second half hour of the first hour today. People, we've had an exercise where we just let people raise the issue that means the most to them right now and that we should discuss. We also have a lot to talk about in terms of the energy picture in California and the all-out assault on renewable energy. It's truly astounding. Gavin Newsom is about to go meet the Pope and hopefully ask forgiveness for his incredible hypocrisy on nuclear power and energy in general. Second hour, starting at 6 o'clock Eastern, 3 o'clock Pacific, we're going to have Ray McClendon come on. There is, and as you know, a tsunami of anti-voting rights legislation coming down the pike and actually being put into law all over the country. Ray is a major leader, along with Andrea Miller, on protecting the ability of people to vote. We've have made some great strides, phenomenal stuff in Arizona, which we talked about last week in terms of hand-marked, hand-counted, digitally scanned paper ballots, which is the way elections need to be conducted. And but unfortunately, we're having a simultaneous assault on the right to vote all over the country, which Ray McClendon has been working with, especially in Georgia, in other ways as well. So the second hour is going to be a real deep dive on protecting the vote. We are going to record that and make it part of the guidebook that we're working on, which will hopefully be ready in a couple of weeks, Green Grassroots Election Protection Guide, so that we can have a decent election this fall. And it's really looking, it's going to be, you know, the fate of the earth is in our hands here. And this is crunch time for the human race, as far as I think we all are well aware. Camilla Reese has certainly been working on that. And we have Tatanka Bricka, that just conducted one of the best KPFK LSBs we've ever had. That's LSB, local station board, not the other LSD. We actually have decent progress to report on the Pacifica Radio Network. I think we're actually moving ahead to save that incredible asset. But let's talk about today's asset, the Green Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition. This is our fifth year, amazingly enough, the 177th meeting. We've had Jerry Ashton on with us before, truly astounding and productive sessions with Jerry. Jerry, you've introduced yourself to us before, but it's been a while since you've been on. Can you basically tell us your amazing background, how you decided to start this campaign, where the campaign is at right now, and what we can do to deal with each one of us to deal with retiring medical debt?
Well, it's bigger than ever.
Yeah, it's astounding.
It's going to be bigger than ever.
Start by giving us the numbers. How much medical debt have you? Well, basically, the situation is, let me see if I get it, that, you know, the people can't pay their medical debts. They get hit with bill collectors. You go in and you pay off at a fraction of the dollar these excessive medical debts, and people are freed. Is that like a decent thumbnail sketch of what you do?
That's pretty close. What happens is that when you and I are caught up in the American medical so-called system, inevitably some of us are going to end up owing more than we have in our pocketbooks or bank accounts or what have you. And yes, people do end up in collections. Hospitals, doctors send people to collections, and pursue the debt. If it isn't collected by a collection agency, they then try a second agency, which will be a little bit more aggressive. If that doesn't work, then they'll turn to what they call debt sellers and debt buyers. A debt buyer will go to a hospital and say, "I see that you have, oh, let me see, $50 million worth of uncollected bills there. I happen to have a couple million dollars rattling in my pocket. Maybe we can make a trade." And so the good hospital, responsible in a fiduciary capacity and needing to squeeze every dime that it can get out of the bottom to, down to the bottom line, they will sell that debt. Your debt, which might be $100, they'll send it, they'll sell it to, for maybe 3 pennies on the dollar. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means you and I, our debt is bought and sold on the open market, like ham hocks, futures, and anything else that you can make a buck off of. But when people buy our debt, they buy it for pennies, but when they decide to collect on it, it's for 100 pennies on the dollar. That's called a scam, as far as I'm concerned. These are bottom feeders. So what did I do? As a former debt collector and a former Navy journalist, I wandered into Occupy Wall Street a few years ago, about 12 to be exact, and 2011, really 13, and I got caught up and resonated to the complaints that were being voiced there. One of them was that medical debt should not exist in a society. Medical debt should not put people into bankruptcy. Medical debt should not cause us to lose our home. And that resonated with me because we're the only industrial nation that will allow our populace to be treated in such a fashion. So, with a partner of mine by the name of Craig Antico, who worked with me in the collections industry, we started a charity called RIP Medical Debt in 2014, January. We are celebrating its 10th birthday this coming week, and we will be announcing that we have abolished close to $12 billion
My God.
worth of medical debt for close to 8 million Americans.
Oh my God. That's astounding. $12 billion and 8 million people that you've freed from medical debt?
Yep.
Don't these hospitals get tired of seeing you coming around?
Well, we started working the system ourselves. And what we did is we petitioned the Health and Human Services, the Office of the Inspector General, and we said, "Look it, you're letting these collection agencies buy medical debt from hospitals and then chase it down. Why don't you allow us as a charity?" And by the way, RIP Medical Debt has changed its name now to Undue, UNDUE Medical Debt. Marketing, branding. But now what we did is we got permission to go directly to hospitals ourselves. And if you take a look at what's in our pipeline and the way that cities and states are very cleverly using the dollars that were not spent during COVID, we're going to free in New York City alone 1 million New Yorkers who owe $2 billion, and that's in the pipeline. So that's what's happening.
Wow. Well, UNDUE, is that what you're going to be?
Yes,
UNDUE?
Undue. Undue. UNDUE medicaldebt.org. I am on the board of that charity. I retired to the board a couple of years ago in order to be able to work on a different front, and that's veterans. When you're ready to talk about that, I'll tell you what we're doing there.
Well, let's jump right in. What's the deal with veterans? And then people, I mean, this is a complicated deal. I want to ask you, you must have repeat people who, get free of medical debt, but then build up more. And also, are you a 501c3? Are donations to your organization tax deductible?
Yes, this is
Okay.
Undue Medical Debt. See where it says erase medical debt? If you scroll down a little bit, that's how much money we're at right now, $11,857,000,000. Okay.
Wow, amazing.
Now, see how we want to work together to fix the broken healthcare finance system. So my charity has gotten very sophisticated and we're going upstream now. Instead of just sweeping up after the parade, we're doing our best to influence legislators, policymakers, what have you, to change the rules of the game so that people don't get abused as they are right now. Now, if you go into the search engine, not search, but if you go into the put up endveterandebt.org. Yes, no, not within the site. They won't show you us there. You have to go up above to get that. There we go. Endveterandebt.org. There we are. And that's what we're asking people to do, is throw veterans a lifeline. You may not know it, but our veterans probably have even worse attention paid to them than insurance companies pay you and me. In fact, the VA hospital system has $6 billion worth of medical debt owed by veterans through their system. $6 billion.
Oh, to the VA? The VA charges these guys?
It's owed through the VA. What the VA does is, when a veteran gets run over, taken by ambulance to a hospital, they submit the ambulance bill and the hospital bill to the VA, and the VA summarily rejects it. That's just how it's done. I'm a veteran. I know what I'm talking about. How do they get away with that? Because healthcare in the VA is dispensed based on who you are, where you served, what your rate is, were you exposed to toxic chemicals? Are you part of Agent Orange? And all these that they determine whether or not you qualify for that bill. And for example, there's one veteran I was working with. He had a heart attack in a civilian hospital and was being pulled into the surgery room. And they said, "Oh, you're a veteran. We better call the VA." They called the VA, and the VA says, "Well, we'll send an ambulance."
Oh my God.
I mean, that's how insane it is. We'll send an ambulance. This is on the East Coast in the DC area. The VA hospital was 60 miles away from where this guy was suffering a heart attack. And so he turned down the invitation to go to the VA. And because he turned down the VA, they rejected the hospital bill.
So was he personally responsible for the hospital bill?
Yes, it's at the discretion of the government as to whether or not you and I, as veterans, qualify for medical care.
Oh my God. So, and what happened to this guy? Did he go bankrupt? I mean, did you follow his financial career?
Yeah, I covered him in a chapter of the book I co-wrote called End Medical Debt. Let me see.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
what happened to the guy?
Well, he's in chapter three, no, chapter five. What the chapter title is, "No Thank You for Your Service." And I covered him and I wrote about him, and I said, this is all the thing that's happening to him. He did not go bankrupt, but he used $30,000 of his life savings to pay it down, and he still ended up in collection, pursued by collection. So
Wow.
what I'm doing right now, I hope, is not delivering anything other than information that needs to be acted on. I'm not anti-VA. I use the VA services, but I know, and all the veterans know, that in too many cases, the VA will just stall you. They won't pay in time, and that destroys any possibility for a veteran to get out from underneath debt when things like that happen.
Oh my God. Steve, did you want to say something, Steve Caruso? Steve,
Yeah,
again? Yeah.
it just goes to show how privatization has taken over the whole American system. There's no stopping the monopolies, how much gouging. I mean, you're like the anti-Paul Singer who would buy the medical debt, or not the medical, but any country's debt, and then turn around and just charge them full rate. Definitely a sign that things are a little bit askew in terms of benefiting the common good for the people, and that we really need to go to single payer and erase all this stuff. I laud your work. You're doing great work, Jerry, and I think that just shows you what we all need to do and strive to achieve in the future.
Well, thank you. You know, the VA could be considered a prototype of a single payer system. If the VA were run exactly as a single payer should be run, and getting rid of the insurance aspect of it, this would be the type of thing that could be a template for what we would call single payer systems right now. It's just that whenever you get people involved and you give them control and territory, all too often it's abused. That doesn't mean that it's always abused, but when it does, it becomes just horribly painful for people that are at the butt end of it. So thank you. So what I'm doing now is I'm asking people to donate to endveterandebt.org
And
because
you are a nonprofit.
we're a 501c3
Right. Okay.
nonprofit, and we're a 501c3 foundation, charitable foundation, which means we can work with foundation charities like yours, for sure. Anybody else a charity, we'd love to partner with them because here's the big news. On June 6th, we are going to launch a nationwide campaign that I'm begging you folks to help me. The campaign is going to take place on June 6th. Does that name, that date ring any bells for anybody here?
D-Day,
D-Day.
the Omaha Beach, the invasion of liberation of mainland Europe.
That's right. Liberation is a great term to use. It was by the Allies. They landed in Normandy 80 years ago on June 6th. That's coming up. 80 years ago, we are launching what we call Debt Day, in which we are going to bring to America's attention that the things that our veterans from World War II did not imagine happens to veterans returning today, ending up with no jobs, homeless, PTSD, heavy drugs. I mean, I could go down through the litany of all the abasement that's done to our veterans, but I won't go into that. The important thing is that the veterans of today are deeply in debt to the extent that this is what leads to suicidal ideation and suicide, the act itself. How do I know this? Because this is a social determinant. Debt is a social determinant that leads to outcomes that you and I do not want to see happen.
Wow.
So we're declaring it as Debt Day, and we're going to combine ourselves with other charities and organizations and individuals who donate to us. We are going to abolish $1 billion of the veteran debt for each year that has passed since 1944. That means $80 million. Now, so you'll understand the numbers. What does it take to go out and buy veteran debt? 3 pennies on the dollar, which means that $30,000 will buy $1 million worth of veteran debt, payday loan debt, car note debt, all the fake universities and schools that scammed veterans out of the GI Bill. That debt, that's what we're going
Wow, fantastic. Myla Reason's got a hand. Myla and then Camilla.
Thank you, Jerry, so much for this extraordinary project.
Thank you.
I have a question, but I just wanted to say that I remember many years ago hearing that more Vietnam veterans had committed suicide than soldiers who had died in the Vietnam War, U.S. soldiers. And you just have to understand that you've got the PTSD and all of the horrors of war combined with this crushing debt. It's just outrageous. And I'm wondering what are the armed services committees of our national government doing about this? And have you approached those committees? And it just seems like this is something that the U.S. government should be paying attention to.
Thank you for that question. And here are the answers. 44 veterans a day will commit suicide.
Oh my God.
The VA, their statistics show that it's only 22 per day. You and I both know that one a day is too much. But the government, in its attempts to try to deal with this horrible problem, and considering that suicide has so many conditions that lead to that, and what they did is 2 years ago, they did a campaign called Mission Daybreak. And the government put up $20 million for organizations that would have an innovative way to reduce veteran suicide. Sound pretty good so far? There were 1,371 organizations, including mine, that put in a solution. Out of 1,371 people who offered solutions to reduce veteran suicide, only 40 were selected. 40. Now, you know damn well with the law of averages, there's got to be more than 40 organizations that could do a damn good job of eliminating veteran suicide. So I'll tell you the kind of hooks that are there. First of all, the people, the 40 organizations that got the money, many of them were the usual suspects, the people that the VA had already done some work with. Secondly, they made sure, this is my conjecture, not blaming them, they made sure that they look good. Because why, what we did, with what I created prior to End Veteran Debt is let's rethink this. That's the name of my public benefit corporation. Let's rethink this. And I said to the VA, here's my offer. I will see to it that if you allow the VA to make available its $6 billion for the medical debt, I would see to it that it would be abolished. Now, can you imagine the freedom that veterans would feel with $6 billion worth of debt lifted off their backs? Do you think that some of them would probably not want to pull a trigger, having learned some pretty good news in that vein? So I knew that was going to happen because what happened is if we did that, it would show that the VA was the bad guys because they'd run up all this debt. Nobody wants to look bad. Nobody wants to look bad. Everybody wants
to look bad. I don't mind. I mean, look at my hair. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
But you worked hard to earn that, Harvey. Yeah.
And the VA.
Oh, Myla, you got muted.
You got muted, Myla.
Yeah, somebody. Anyway, I'm just saying that the VA does not look good here, nor does the United States government at this point, not taking care of the veterans. In fact, driving them to suicide because of this ridiculous system.
Yes.
Let's hear from Camilla Reese. Camilla.
Thank you. Yes,
thank you. As many questions as possible. I put my email in the chat box, by the way, for those of you who want to write me. So
go ahead, Camilla.
Okay, thank you. Yes, so I'm trying to get my head around the economics of how you can buy debt for 3 cents on the dollar. What is it in for the hospitals?
What's in it for the hospital is something rather than nothing. If I'm given $3 million for $100 million worth of medical debt that I can't collect, that's sitting on my books, I've already gone through collection, two collections. I've sent out invoices. Nobody's paying me. So when somebody comes along with $3 million to buy what is worthless to me, that's a pretty good decision.
That's really shocking. So people can donate to your nonprofit to enable you to buy the debt from not just the veterans, but other people as well.
Exactly.
And they get their tax deduction for donating to your 501c3.
That's
okay.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah, I got it. And I certainly really appreciate your point about the veterans system being an example of a single payer system that doesn't work very well, you know? And it's so that's not the
and
only
we're paying. And we're the ones paying.
Yeah, that's not the only answer. I'm actually working on some writing right now and what the other part of the answer is. But anyway, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Gary O'Connor, I think, has raised his hand.
Yeah, go ahead, Gary. Camilla, thank you. Gary, go ahead. Gary, are you unmuted? All right. Trying to unmute Gary here. This is the one little loggerhead that we run into. Oh, there we go. All right, go ahead, Gary.
I heard Carrie Harrison on KPFK just a month or two ago with a very good program on medical debt. Are you associated with him? He was very enthusiastic, impressive.
No, Carrie is a good friend of mine, and I worked with him early on to bring attention to veterans. And we have created a show called, what was that called? Rethinking Heroes.
Yeah.
That's right. Rethinking Heroes. And he went on to do other things, and I'm going to circle back to him because what we're doing is just a natural, just like it would be for you to talk to us about what we're doing for veterans. Thank you.
Okay, we got Paul Newman. Paul Newman in L.A.
Hi. I just wanted to say that things are really getting bad with their hedge funds and all these other Wall Street organizations that are buying hospitals, buying doctors, and creating firms and making healthcare far more expensive and prohibited.
Yes.
And I find this to be rather interesting. And it just seems to be snowballing out of control now. And I mean, it's insane. So debt may be even going up more. And the ability on collection may change, you know, because they have their thumbs in politicians' wallets, you know, and donations and lobbying and everything.
I can give you some good news there. I'm good friends with the CFPB. And keep in mind, I'm a former...
Wait, what's the CFPB?
Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. These are the ones that make sure that you and I aren't screwed over by the usual unscrupulous vendors, corporations, organization, and they watch over the collection agencies as well to be sure that they don't abuse their rightful business work.
But I have a question, though. I noticed that when the people can't afford to pay bills, there are organizations that will find a way of financing it. But it seems that these organizations also are supporting private organizations where they can get money through this. You know what I'm saying? They're Yes. using the federal government to drain it, in other words.
Yes. I just saw
like
a note.
Obamacare.
I just saw a note on the screen about the debt collective. Whoever's interested in that, let me tell you a background of the debt collective. When Occupy Wall Street was in action, I joined various groups, student debt, media outreach, alternate banking. And when I was courted by Occupy to be their back office to help them go buy debt so that they could forgive it to get some publicity. And I was also writing at the time for the Huffington Post, so I made sure that I got some publicity for them as well. We worked with them, Craig Antico and I, for about almost two years, when they came up to us one day and said, and this, by the way, was under the name that they had called the Rolling Jubilee. The Rolling Jubilee.
I know Jubilee.
Yep. And that's a good
forgiving
thing.
Debt.
It's a wonderful, historic, wonderful thing. So we were working with them. And then they came up one day when Occupy was beginning to dissipate and we were being kicked out of the park. They came up to us and they said, well, we're shutting down the Rolling Jubilee because we're going in a different direction. Well, that's okay. I was giving my work for free and Craig was being paid to do the work that you need to do to buy and send out the letters and stuff like that. But we looked at each other and we said, we can't let this happen. We were hooked to be able to take people out of medical debt. So that's when we decided to start RIP Medical Debt. And then we discovered that our friends had gone after student debt. And so they created what they call the Debt Collective. And the Debt Collective has done a damn good job of getting student debt abolished. I admire those folks, but they don't talk to me anymore. I don't know why it is. You know how people get into their little silos.
But what does that have to do with getting money out of? In other words, there's these programs that where money is being drained from public to private using these aid, using financial aid. But it's the government that's paying for you, and it's going to a private organization.
Well, let me try to be more direct in my answer. What you're talking about, financial aid, one is you can get a credit card, a medical credit card. Well, never put medical debt on a credit card to begin with. Never, because you can never identify it as being medical debt anymore. It goes along with your big screen TV and buying that new pair of shoes. Never put medical debt on a credit card if you can help it. So the bankers, Wall Street, figured out a great way to help you pay your bill to the hospital as they, with the hospital, pushed a credit card that people could apply for so that the hospital's debt would be on the credit card's debt, which of course meant that the hospital took a haircut. But now these people had all this debt chasing it down for their exorbitant interest rates. Does that help?
Yeah.
This is Carla in Minnesota. I have a question.
Yes, Carla, go ahead.
Carla. Okay. I am on several 501c3s in Minnesota, and we're getting money. But we have administrative fees. Are you doing all this for free, or how is this working with you? Are you getting paid? Are you getting paid? Who's doing all the work?
Let me tell you. When I started RIP Medical Debt, it took me 2 years maxing out my credit cards, friends and family, the whole disaster, until finally I built RIP Medical Debt up so that I could be paid some money. And yes, I was paid nicely, 10 grand a month, $120,000 a year. And I still chose to retire to the board with no money in order to start in veteran debt to run myself again in debt up to my ears, credit cards maxed. Why would anybody do that? Because they're crazy. So the reason I did that is because I know that enough people will show up and care about veterans that they will give us large sums of money. And as a foundation, we can use this money to feed other charities. That's the difference. Rather than being just a charity, I'm a charitable foundation. I can accept donations, which is tax deductible, and I can give away that money as long as it's part of a veteran scheme. Does that help, Mike Hirsch?
So does the organization cover your psychiatric bills for having been so crazy?
I wish.
Mike Hirsch, go ahead. Mike, please.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Jerry, you're such an inspiration. The work that you're doing is so tremendous. And it's just great to hear all the bankers screaming and crying when you're doing the same thing to them that they do to all of us. I just want to underscore, the Veterans Administration is by and large a very good organization. The problem has been it hasn't been funded properly. And especially since we're nonpartisan, but we can discuss history. W. Bush got us into two wars at once. Meanwhile, he was slashing taxes on a lot of people, including those big banks that are now screwing us over. Yep. And he did not fund the VA. And it's partially maybe because he's a coward who skipped out of Vietnam, even though he supported the war, claimed that he had bunions or Lord knows what it was that kept him out.
It's because he's a Republican and a capitalist.
Well, we're nonpartisan, but there are some Democrats who are also
there's equal opportunity for everybody to be a sinner here.
But that's right.
We'd like to forgive the ones who want to expiate their sins by making sure that you do fund the VA.
That's right.
The VA help you to the extent that it has enough doctors, it has supplies, what have you.
That's right. And to their credit, Bernie Sanders and the late John McCain worked together to do as much as they could to help our veterans out. But there's never enough that we can do for our veterans. A lot of them have been kind of hornswoggled into serving our country. A lot of them do it out of pride in the country and a sense of commitment to the country. A lot of them do it because of the poverty draft. That's a whole other thing. But when they come out, especially if they've seen combat, but it doesn't really matter if they've served stateside or wherever they've served, they have served this country and they deserve our respect and more than our respect, more than, you know, all this, you know, parades and whatnot. They need to have their bills paid. They shouldn't be left hanging. They shouldn't be left homeless. They shouldn't be left emotionally devastated. They shouldn't be left burdened with healthcare debt. And Jerry, thank you again so much for everything that you're doing to pay our veterans back that debt that they've paid for our country.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry. I do want to call attention to one senator and a guy who worked with him who did tremendous things for the veterans, and that was John Glenn, who was a senator from Ohio. And I recalled that I worked with a guy. He was a co-author of our book, Killing Our Own. I'm going to have him on in the near future, and you should come on with him, Jerry. Bob Alvarez. Bob did the first citizens' hearings on radiation health impacts, and he also was responsible for the hearings that were in Congress on Agent Orange. And as you know, the U.S. military denied up and down for years and years and years that Agent Orange had any impact on the health of the veterans there and that went to Vietnam. And a lot of the guys who really suffered after the Vietnam War, we talk about the suicide rate among PTSD veterans, Agent Orange really did a number on our veterans. And it was a total denial on the part of the government that that Agent Orange had any impact. So,
yeah, this is where I get very upset about the government end of it. I can understand lobbyists paying people a lot of money to make sure that a bill goes in a certain direction. But how is it that, for example, with burn pits, which is the latest fight that veterans have had with the VA, they would not acknowledge that burn pits created cancers in our servicemen and women. And if it wasn't for, who's that, John Stewart. He's the patron
saint. John Stewart, right.
He's the patron saint for veterans because he finally helped get it over the line to be able to see that veterans were going to be treated for everything that comes out of burn pits, all the diseases.
Yeah, and isn't Biden's son, wasn't he harmed by cancer from a burn pit? Isn't that part of the story?
That's part of the story.
Yes. Well, Jerry Ashton, you're a true hero. It's really great to have you on with you. Of course, then there's a question of the cycle of, you know, when is this cycle of our medical system that kills people with debt going to end? Let's go to Camille. Camille, I hope you'll recognize this T-shirt I'm wearing. Go ahead, please. Camilla Reese?
Yeah. Hi. Okay, so what I'm trying to understand is it's wonderful that you can buy the debt at a discount and you get donors to your nonprofit to underwrite it and relieve the veterans or the people of their medical debt. That's wonderful. But is there any potential recourse back to the government in the case of the veterans for exactly this situation that you know, they don't pay the bills, they, you know, transfer people an hour away when they're having a heart attack, all these different things? Is there any recourse, any legal recourse back to the government?
There's always legal recourse. The only question is, do people have the time and the money and the resources to pull that off? And mm-hmm. one of the values of charities and veterans and veteran supporters of banding together is that there's enough money available to be able to do that, Kamala.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, and nothing catches the attention more of the VA than a letter written to your local congressman or woman. And I was recently worked with an organization called ResistBot. I'm sure some of you must be familiar with ResistBot. If not, I want to refer you on to it because for a small fee, they came out of, with a name like ResistBot, you can tell they're exactly what their attitude is about things. They want to see things change. And so they've set up some very clever letter writing campaigns that can be done by going to their website, that'd be resistbot.com, I think, and you can do a campaign. And that campaign will, with small amount of money, will send letters to your legislators. And that gets a lot more attention than the phone calls that, as you know, you end up in voicemail. I recommend.
Wow, that's interesting. So this organization, ResistBot, tell us how it works. I'm not exactly clear. And then we'll get to Lynn Feinerman. Lynn has a hand.
Well, yes, ResistBot, we're going to be using them in our campaign. Now, by the way, this campaign, $30,000 gets rid of $1 million of the veteran debt. We don't have to do it all at once, but on June 6th, it would be nice that enough of us got together to come up with at least $1 million of the debt to blast this thing off. So I'm just putting that in your think tank. Now, that made me forget the original question.
ResistBot. You know, I'd like, if you can get us someone or get us contacted with them, we can bring them on. I would like to hear more about ResistBot. Why don't we go to Lynn Feinerman? Lynn's a great guest. She's a radio host in Northern California. Lynn, go ahead.
Thank you, Harvey. And thank you, Jerry. The work is just fantastic and so much deserved by those who serve. My question is very specific. As regards recourse back to the government, there are new bills that have been passed recently that strongly curtail class action suits. How does that affect a thing like what you're talking about going back to the government?
Well, I'm not sure about the blanket inability for us as citizens or veterans to do a class action suit. I don't know enough about that. What I can tell you is that when veterans band together and veteran supporters like yourselves who say, let's right this wrong, and we create a campaign, and the campaign is what gets the attention of the legislators along with a writing campaign. And Harvey, I will be happy to introduce you to ResistBot's.
Yeah, please. Absolutely.
People. So, Lynn, I'm sorry to say I don't have enough details on that, but I can do some research.
All right. So, and I am glad to hear, you know, things like Occupy Wall Street. You know, we have these demonstrations that occur, and then they fade away. And, you know, Occupy Wall Street, we got the 99% thing out of it, and they fade away. And you wonder if anything ever came of it. And here we hear that Well, you know, this incredible organization that you do, this incredible campaign that you do, came out of Occupy Wall Street. Sure. I'm really glad to hear that, you know.
And
I'll tell you two things. I've worked for decades with a guy named Kevin Camps in the anti-nuclear movement. This is a story to just make you understand that everything you do has an impact. So I used to go around the country speaking in you know, churches and basements and stuff like that. And you always wonder, I would show up, I would travel, you know, 500 miles and speak to six people. And you always wonder, what the heck are you doing? So I had this guy, Kevin Camps, a wonderful guy, he's been on our talks. I was riding around, I worked with him for a long time. I went riding around in a car and I asked him how he got involved in the anti-nuclear movement. And he gave me a really funny look and he said, well, you got me involved. I heard that you speak at Kalamazoo. I kind of remember I spoke to like, you know, four people in a basement, but I guess one of them was Kevin. And so, you know, what you're doing is just has an enormous impact. It leads to my greatest story. This is my favorite story about activism. I spoke at Ohio Wesleyan with Jeremy Rifkin. Jeremy Rifkin is a very, very well-known futurist and draws huge crowds wherever he goes. But I was telling him, we were talking about the perils of the road. And I told him I once flew from Miami to Duluth and I spoke to five people. And he said, well, he wouldn't fly for a long time. He said he took a train from D.C. to Denver and spoke to two people. And then he said, but, you know, you got to give the whole speech because you never know if one of them might be Gandhi. And I later heard a story that Bertrand Russell, and I think I've told this on that, Bertrand Russell actually called a giant peace march to convene in Trafalgar Square in London. And he did all this publicity, and one person showed up, but it was Gandhi. So, you know, because Gandhi was in law school in London, and he showed up. So there you go. So the other thing is, and this is this is going to sound far afield, but I spoke actually once in Russia. It was on the 10th anniversary of Chernobyl, and I had been to a conference in Kiev, and which was incredibly depressing. You know, talking to people who had been harmed by the fallout from Chernobyl, and then I was introduced in Kaliningrad. It was the weirdest experience I ever had giving a speech. They called the thing. I was representing Greenpeace, and they called a rally, and there were like 100 people at the rally. It was a really cool rally, and all of a sudden, the military marches up. These guys were in Russian uniform, and they pull out their guns, their rifles. And I said, "Oh God, we're cooked!" And they lifted their rifles in the air, and they gave me a 21-gun salute. And it turned out. And this is complicated, but it's really worth hearing. After, during Chernobyl, in the worst of the accident, the Soviets, and they had a drafty army, and they sent these guys, they sent 600,000. I thought, when I first saw that, I thought this was a typo. The Soviet military sent 600,000 soldiers, draftees, into Chernobyl, into the power plant, to run in for 90 seconds, allegedly, and like throw a brick off a roof and run out. They had to clean up the place, but it was too radioactive. And they sent these guys in. And the guys later, you know, years later became, this was 10 years later I was talking to them, became 20-somethings and 30-somethings. And they all got cancer. I mean, the cancer rate, they were called liquidators, right? That was the term that was used, liquidators. And they had a horrendous cancer rate, like our guys from Vietnam. And I remember during and after the war in Vietnam, the fiercest group that we worked with, and Tatanka, I'm sure, remember, and other people who organized, the fiercest group that we had against the war was the Vietnam Vets Against the War. They were absolutely ferocious. I mean, incredibly angry. They were all dying from Agent Orange and PTSD, you know, enormous suicide rate. So when I was in Kaliningrad, the reason, and the rally we gave, we had the mayor and the governor there. And this was as, you know, just as the Soviet Union was, you know, gone. These guys had all been liquidators in Chernobyl, and they had grown up and they took over the government in Kaliningrad. And they're the reason the Soviet Union fell. And, you know, you have to want, and interviewing these guys was one of the most moving experiences of my life. Just talking to these guys who've been, their lives have been ruined by 90 seconds in Chernobyl. And in fact, if you go, and I highly recommend, there's an HBO series. It's a 5-part series on Chernobyl. And they do have, you know, a portrayal of what these guys went through. They show people, you know, it's a, you know, it's a simulation. It's dramatized, but they show these guys going in there, running in and running out, which is what happened to the liquidators. And they're the ones who brought down the Soviet Union. They really did, these guys. And I'm, and then you have to wonder what happened to their, you know, in the medical system in Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union to deal with all these guys dying of cancer. And I'll bet you they got zero care of any meaning. And who knows what, you know, the system was for medical bills. But it really resonates. So I strongly recommend, everybody I've talked to on the nuclear issue, but if you're at all interested in the worst thing that probably ever happened to veterans, look at the segment in the HBO series on Chernobyl. It's mind-boggling what these guys were put through. And that, you're talking about 600,000 people, you know, an enormous chunk of the world's population that was just exposed at Chernobyl. And you have to, God knows, wonder what happened to them medically, and then if they had debt, and how that impacted everything. So there you go. Mike Hirsch, please.
Yeah, thanks for that reminder, Sluggo. And it just strikes me how everybody cheers our men and women off to war, but then when they come home, nobody wants to know them. Nobody but Jerry and the people on this Zoom. And I hope that's enough. And I think that we're doing great things here. And Sluggo, thank you for pointing out that, you know, people in uniform are treated, you know, like dog food by people, by the so-called leaders all around the country. It's a terrible thing. And it's one more reason why we, all of us, demand peace and diplomacy as opposed to this warfare, which too often, in my opinion, is nothing but a money laundering scheme for the military-industrial complex. But I didn't come up with that. A certain former general named Eisenhower brought that up a number of times. And he was right. And his words were prophetic, unfortunately. Yep. And Jerry, if you wanted to, you know, weigh in on that and just how we're using our veterans and our troops as kind of a scheme to shake down the taxpayers.
Well, there are so many. There's a fellow by the name of Smedsrud or something like that. It was a Marine general.
Smedley Butler.
What's his name?
It was Smedley Butler.
Smedley Butler. And which he wrote, he said, war is a racket. And right, that's exactly what it is. Now, when you take a look at what can I do as an individual? Well, I really encompasses everybody you know and you touch. It's just whether or not you're willing to share with and talk with these people and be vigilant about making sure that people understand the truth. I'm going to give you my forecast. When I started RIP medical debt, nobody talked about healthcare debt. Nobody talked about medical debt. I guarantee you, which is why Occupy Wall Street was so important. I didn't even know about medical debt, the way it was being treated. And I was a debt collector. But when I heard what was going on and how it was going on, and I delved into what it was all about, changed my mind, changed my profession, walked in Occupy Wall Street as a debt collector, walked out as a debt forgiver. It can happen. So here's the secret now. Persistence over resistance, number one. And there are four things that are going to prove to you that in the next, between now and 10 years from now, veterans will be treated and be made aware of more than anything than ever in their life because of people like you and me starting to become aware. And once you're aware and you're touched by something and you get educated, well, once you're aware and once you're touched and once you're educated, there's only one thing left, action, whether it be feet on the street or you name it. You do it, even better. Don't name it, do it.
And since we're joined by Ray McClendon here, who's going to take over at the top of the hour and give us the lowdown on election theft. We got 47 people with us. And thank you, Steve and Mike and everybody, for making this possible. Jerry, you're a great guest. I want to tell you as a historian that the mistreatment, the maltreatment, the unconscionable bad things that are done to veterans that come back from wars is a historic phenomenon. You're jumping in the dead here. If you read the literature after the Revolutionary War, these guys were treated terribly. You know, the guys who won Yorktown and Saratoga and got wounded. I mean, they were just treated like trash. Great heroes, you know, big parades coming home, and then, you know, off to the dust heap for you. The worst actually was in the Civil War. This is an amazing story. In the middle of the Civil War, you know, we're doing amputations. I mean, medical care in the middle of the Civil War was incredibly primitive. And in the middle of the Civil War, they started using morphine. You know, it was, I'm sure Nancy knows about this as a doctor. Morphine came in pretty much into use in the middle of the Civil War. And what happened after the Civil War? You had a plague, a horrible national curse of morphine addiction. Because these vets who were treated medically during the Civil War with morphine got addicted. Nobody knew what was happening. You had a whole generation of dope addicts that came out of the Civil War. Nobody ever talks about that, you know. And World War One, the same thing, you know. And World War Two, you know, thank God we had Franklin Roosevelt and they were treated a little better. But Vietnam, total trashy, horrible situation. And God knows, you know.
Well, this is the difference between June 6, 1944, when we landed in Normandy, and a year or so later declared victory in Europe. What made the difference for those folks when they came home versus the veterans who are returning home now is that they were welcomed home. They were given generous GI bills. They were given generous housing.
Right. And education.
Yeah. And by the way, there weren't any jobs, so the smartest thing that the government did was to put them in school. And when they put them in school, they got smarter. And when they got smarter, they got out and ran businesses. And that's why everything grew so well during the 50s and the 60s. I know.
Yes.
We
had the world's best educated workforce after World War II. Now what do we got? You know, anyway, Tatanka Brekka, and then we're going to roll on. I mean, this is an amazing hour, Jerry. Just absolutely, you know, irreplaceable. We're going to have you keep coming back. You're great.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Adios, everybody.
No, wait.
Jerry, I just want to thank you so much. And I will call you. I have an idea I want to follow up with you. It may help out. I just want to say also that we all know the story of the 2,000 to 3,000 veterans that showed up at Standing Rock, right, to make amends, went down on a knee to apologize for their role in what happened to veterans. And that was the thing that got Obama to shut the pipeline down. It turned out, you know, when Trump came in, everything restarted. The oil is still flowing under the Missouri River, despite everything they've done legally and everything. It's still happening. But what I want to say is the action that they did is the action that all of us need. We need to find a national campaign for all of us to start there, all of us, to make amends for that and then go on to slavery. Because the gathering of us together and the ending of the endless wars will be predicated on us taking responsibility, you know, for what we're doing. Because what's playing out in Ukraine and what's playing out in Gaza is just a repeat of the colonization that happened to us and that we repeated. We all know Hitler's idea for the death camps came from how the U.S. government set up reservations for the native people, etc. So we have, being born at this time, we have an opportunity to take responsibility for our history. And out of that, you know, join the citizens of humans. And whatever happens to this nation will be done in a good way. It may not even end up as a nation in the future. Who the heck knows? But if we're going to have the survival of the human race and the survival of a planet that can still generate life, we need to integrate that action along with everything else we do. That's all I'll say now.
Thank you. Thank you, Tatanka. Thank you. Paul Newman's got a split. Thank you very much, Paul, for being with us. Jerry, you're great. It's really great. We got another great guy to take the torch here. Ray McClendon's with us. If you want to stick with us, and we're going to go now a deep dive. That was an amazing session. Anybody wants to get in touch with Jerry Ashton, write me directly or look in the chat, and we will definitely continue this theme on retiring medical and other debts. Thank you for that, Tatanka. Okay, we're going to switch over now. And this, maybe Steve, if you want to break the tape or whatever, we want to be offering Ray's presentation as a renewable videotape and link. And what Ray says to us now is going to be transcribed and be part of the guidebook that we're trying to produce within the next week or two for grassroots organizing in the United States in the coming election. The People's Guide to Grassroots Election Organizing 2024, and Ray is a big part of that. So Ray is in Georgia, has a new organization, and has been a pioneer in election protection. Been with us many, many times before. And Ray, what we're going to start with is the horrendous wave of anti-voter legislation that's coming down in Georgia and around the country. So if you could just give yourself a brief introduction. We got 45 people and we're live, and this will, of course, be rebroadcast and provide a big part of the literature. So if you'll jump on in, Ray, the forum is yours.
Sure. Thanks. And hello to everybody. And this is a subject that we've covered many times. But I wanted to step back a little and let's give it the strategic context that it needs. And we know that this really all started to be reversed with Shelby County decision back in 2013, where the preclearance provisions were stripped away because we had a court that had said that all of that discrimination, all of the voter suppression that had occurred for decades, for almost a century across the South, was now over. And with that, the states that had previously been a part of preclearance began to systematically to take steps to turn back the clock. And we've seen more and more ingenious ways of doing that over the last 11 years. SB 202, many of you will remember, was one of the major voter suppression laws in the United States, right here in Georgia, that was a model that many provisions of which were utilized in other legislation across the country. That legislation went so far, as you will recall, to penalize providing water and snacks to people who were in long line.
Please catch the rest of the show at grassrootsep.org, and please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel at Green Grassroots Election Protection Coalition. Thanks.